The 13th Candle by Tuesday Love Sang Grandpa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 7. Lady St. John de Tofnows of Helsopoppen Hall sat in solitary grandeur at the head of the immense table in her breakfast room. Fastidiously, she toyed with the thin slice of rye bread toast before her. Delicately, she raised a teacup to her well-shaped lips, then, on an impulse, put it down in the saucer and hurried off to her ornate writing desk. Selecting a sheet of writing paper bearing the crest of a famous Norman, really, he was named Guillaume, ancestor, and consisting of a bald-headed cuckoo rampant, given because he was a bit cuckoo but always went at a thing bald-headed, she started to write with a pen which had been pinched from one of the Duke of Wellington's footmen, who had pinched it from a tavern off Fleet Street. "So you are the author of The Third Eye," she wrote. "I wish to see you. Meet me at my club, and be sure to wear a civilized Western dress. I have my position to consider." Bertie E. Cutsum, one of the leading surgeons of England, member of that most learned society, fellow of this and that, bon vivant, clubman, an advocate of privileges for the privileged classes, sat in his office, chin in hand. At last, after profound cogitation, he seized a sheet of discreetly monogrammed paper and started. "I have just read The Third Eye," he wrote, "and I know that all you write is true. My son has marked occult powers, and he knows from other sources that you write the truth. I should like to meet you, but please return this letter, as my colleagues would laugh at me." The wealthy Californian filmmaker sat in his palatial office, surrounded by his almost naked harem. Silva screen was now a household word. Years before, he had come to the States from Greece, and like hot Greece, he ran away from the hot time if he stayed in Greece. The police wanted to put him in the cooler, so off to America he dashed and landed in Frisco with a hole in his pants and holes in his soles. His soul was not in too good a condition either. Now, the great man, Silva Screen, sat in his office and tried to write a letter without his secretary typing it. Idly he sat and twirled his solid gold pen, the one studded with diamonds and with the whacking great ruby at the end of the opposite of the nib. His face contorted, he fumbled with his shattered English. At last, when the suspense was becoming painful, he reached out and seized a gaudy sheet of paper and started to write. In effect, the letter demanded the presence of the author of The Third Eye, so that the great Greek god of the silver screen could have his fortune told and perhaps increased. He enclosed the money for return airfare. With extreme pain, he wrote a check and enclosed it in the envelope. A minion rushed to mail the missive. Silva Screen sat mulling in his office. Pain assailed him in his pocketbook. "What have I done?" he cried. My money she is spent. I go foolish. No matter, I now go wise. He heaved his swelly belly up so that it was supported by the expensive desk and quickly called his secretary. To the author of the third eye, he dictated, you have my money. You I don't want. My money I do want. And if you don't return my money fast, I tell the press you took my money. So you send my money fast, eh? A functionary functioned at top speed to hasten the dispatch of the missive to the author. At last, in the fullness of time, for the mails are very slow, Silva Screen the Greek could rub his greasy hands on his returned money. In faraway Uruguay, the author of many books received a letter from Seattle, USA. I am told you want to return to North America, stated this letter from a very wealthy man. But you do not have the money for your fare. Now I will make a very good proposition to you. I will pay your fare to Seattle, and I will keep you for the rest of your life. You will have one room and your food. You should not want many clothes. In return, you must turn over everything you have to me, and you must legally sign over all book rights to me. Then I will market your books and keep your royalties in return for keeping you. The author uttered an unmentionable word in an unmentionable manner about that unmentionable person. The door resounded to a thunderous knocking, a knocking repeated as it was not instantly opened, hurrying footsteps, the sound of the door opening. "Just a peek, I take, no," said a thick, guttural voice. "Von Lama, I come to see, and you should let me come, yes?" The sounds of voices and the volume of one increasing. "Mine friend, she say you go, she say, you say you want for the Lama to see, she say. Upon your doorstep I will live mit mine self and will stay yet already. You tell him Wilhelmina Sherman is here, no?" Midnight in Montreal. Across the water, the lights of the skyscrapers of Drapeau's dream were reflecting in the unruffled waters of the port. Motionless at anchor, the ships rested placidly, the advent of another day. To the left, where Windmill Basin afforded moorings for the tugs, the water was suddenly roiled as a small boat got under way to meet a late-coming freighter. Atop the tallest building, a rotating beacon sent probing fingers into the night sky. A jet plane whistled across the city as it escaped from the confines of the international airport. Midnight in Montreal, the household was wrapped in sleep, sleep which suddenly was shattered by the insistent ringing of the doorbell. Clothes were quickly donned and the door was opened. Only dire emergency would prompt such a long ring at such an hour, surely. "Rampa?" asked a gruff French-Canadian voice. "Dr. Rampa live here?" Two big men pushed their way in and stood looking around. "Police, fraud squad," said one at length. "Who is this Dr. Rampa? What does he do? Where is he?" asked the other. Questions, questions, questions. But then a counter-question. "What do you want? Why have you come here?" The two policemen looked at each other blankly. The senior of the two, without even asking permission, strode to the telephone and dialed a number. There followed a rapid-fire exchange of the French-Canadian version of the French language. At last, the phone was put down and the senior policeman said, "We were told to come here. Called in our police car. We were not told why. Now the superintendent says a man called him from Alabama and said to tell Dr. Rampa to call him fast. It is urgent. Do it now." Uneasily, the two policemen stood and looked at each other. They shifted their weight from one leg to the other. At last the senior said, "We'll go. You telephone immediately, yes?" They turned and stumped out of the room. Soon there came the sound of their car starting and zooming along the road far in excess of the legal speed limit. Then came the ringing of the phone. "Superintendent of police here. Have you telephoned yet?" "The man said it was urgent, a matter of life and death." There was a click, and the call was ended. The letter plopped in together with about 70 others. The envelope was of a violent mauve hue, with improbable flowers fore and aft. The paper, when unfolded, was of the same horrendous color, worsened by hanging wreaths of flowers entwined all around the edge. "God is love," proclaimed a banner across the top. The author wrinkled his nose at the stink coming from it. The scent used must have come from a diseased skunk who had died after eating, he thought. The letter said, "I am Auntie Macassar, and I tell fortunes and do much good. $5 a question, or a bigger love offering. Now, I have read your books, and I want you to be my guide. It will do me a power of good in my advertising. Send me your letter agreeing fast, because I want to advertise it." "Rampa has gone commercial," shrieked the letter. "I know you are a fake, because you run businesses and make money." The poor, wretched author lay back in his bed and tried to work that one out. Did it mean that all people engaged in business were fakes, or what? "Oh, well," he thought, "I will make it clear in my next book." Ladies and gentlemen, children, cats of all description, listen to this statement, this proclamation and declaration. I, Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, using my own and legal name and my only name, depose thus. I have no business interests. I am not engaged in business of any kind, except that of an author. I do not endorse any incense, mail-order firms, or whatnots. Certain people are using names such as The Third Eye, but I wrote a book by that name, not started a mail-order company, a mail-order company which I do not endorse. Ladies and gentlemen, children, cats of all description, I have no disciples, no students, representatives, followers, pupils, business interests, or any agents other than my literary agents. Nor have I written any books refused by publishers because of their forbidden knowledge. Someone may be trying to part you from your hard-earned money. I wish I could do it. So you have been warned by me. The author lay back and dwelt upon the difficulties of being an author. You must not use the word crummy, wrote one. It is bad language. You must not use I, wrote another. It makes your readers identify themselves too closely with you. That's bad. You must not say you are the old man, complains yet another. I don't like to read it. And so the letters go on. So the author, who else, lay back and pondered upon the past and worried unduly, perhaps, about the future, failing health, failing this and failing that. The door was pushed open, and a beautiful furry form jumped lightly on the bed where the author was lying, thinking of the past. Hey, Gov, she said in her best Siamese cat telepathic voice, and how about the book you're supposed to be writing? You will never get it finished if you think of all those silly ninnies, the Fairweather friends. Forget 'em, she commanded sternly. Fat Taddy strolled in and sat in a vagrant patch of sunlight. Food, she inquired. Did someone mention food? The author smiled at them and said, well, cats, we have to finish this book, and we have to answer some of those questions which come pouring in. Questions, questions, questions. So, let us start. He reached out for the typewriter with a sticking eye and dragged it towards him. Now, where is that first question? The difficulty is that just as people beget people, so do answers beget questions. The more questions are answered, the more questions seem to arise. Now, here's a question which seems to have troubled a lot of people. The question is, what is this over-self? Why does the over-self make me suffer so much? How can it be just that I have to suffer so when I do not know why I have to suffer? It doesn't make sense. It destroys my faith in religion. It destroys my faith in a God. Can you explain this to me? The author lay back and contemplated a passing ship. Once again, a ship was coming, bringing all manner of goods from Japan, but that was not getting on with the book, was it? The author reluctantly turned back and started to work again. Yes, of course, such a question can be answered, but first of all, we have to agree to certain terms of reference, because think of trying to discuss with a fish in the depths of the ocean the thoughts and reactions of spacemen in orbit around the moon. How could we get it over to a fish, which always lived in the bottom of the ocean, what life was like on the surface of the ocean? How would we explain life in London, Montreal, Tokyo, or even New York, where there are many queer fish already? But beyond this, how would we explain to our seabed-dwelling fish what happens to a spaceship going around the moon? It would be just about impossible, wouldn't it? So let us make an assumption. Let us imagine something different. Let us imagine that the over-self is not the over-self anymore, it's just a brain. So we get a lot of brains floating about somewhere. And then the brain decides it wants to know something. It wants to experience something other than pure thought. By pure thought, it is meant that thought is an insubstantial thing and does not concern itself with pure or impure in the moral sense of the meaning. This particular brain, then, has the stirrings of ambition. It wants to know things. It wants to know what things are like on Earth. Is the 13th candle hotter than the 12th candle? And what is hot, anyway? And then, what is a candle? The brain decides to find out. So the brain finds a body. Forget, for the moment, that the brain has to be born first. But this brain gets itself fixed inside a skull, a thick, bony box in which it floats in a special liquid which prevents it from experiencing mechanical shocks, which keeps it moist and which helps to feed it. Here we have this brain in its bony box. Now, a brain is quite without feeling. That is, if a surgeon wants to operate on a brain, he just gives a local anesthetic to the skin and flesh outside the skull. And then he makes an incision nearly all the way around the head. Then a saw is used through the top of the skull, which can then be peeled back like taking the top off a hard-boiled egg. It is important to remember that one experiences pain only in the flesh and the bone and the skin. The brain is not sensitive to pain, so when the surgeon has got the lid off, so to speak, he can poke and probe and cut into the brain without any anesthetic being used. Our brain is like the over-self. It has no sensation of its own. So, let us go back to the brain in the skull, which is wanting experience. We must keep in mind, though, that we are using the simile of the brain to stand in the place of the over-self, which, being a many-dimensional object, is harder to comprehend. The brain wants to know about sensations. The brain is blind, it is deaf, it cannot detect a scent, it has no feeling. So, we make a lot of puppets. One pair of puppets are extended in the form of eyes. The eyes come open and the brain receives impressions from the eyes. As we all know, a newborn baby cannot understand what the impressions mean. A newborn baby fumbles and obviously does not comprehend what he is seeing, but with experience, the impressions received from the eyes mean something to the brain. But that could be improved upon. We want more than a picture. We can see a thing, but what does it feel like? Does it have a scent? Does it have a sound? Other puppets are put out and they call themselves ears. They catch vibrations of a lower frequency than the eyes can receive. They are still vibrations, just as sight is receiving vibrations. But the ears pick up vibrations, and with practice, the brain can understand that these vibrations mean something. They mean pleasant music, they may mean unpleasant music, they may mean speech in a form of communication. Well, having seen and heard a thing, does it smell? The best way is to move puppets to form an olfactory organ. Then the poor, wretched over-self, which here we are calling the brain, may sometimes wish that there was no sense of smell. It depends on what kind of scent the woman is wearing. To go farther, what does a thing feel like? We do not know the meaning of terms such as hard and soft unless we have feeling. So the over-self, or in this case the brain, puts out more puppets. Arms, hands, fingers. We have a finger and a thumb so that we can pick up a small article. We have fingers which we may move over an object to know whether it is easily compressed or not compressible, to know whether it's soft or hard. We know if it is blunt or if it is sharp through our fingers. Sometimes a thing will hurt. We touch an article and it gives us a most unpleasant sensation. It might be hot, it might be cold, it might be sharp or rough. Those sensations create pain, and the pain warns us to be careful of such things in the future. But why should the fingers revile themselves or revile a god because they are merely carrying out their allotted purpose, the purpose of feeling? A bricklayer may get hard fingers through handling bricks. A surgeon may get very sensitive fingers because of the necessary delicacy of touch required in his job. To do bricklaying would harm the surgeon's fingers, but surgery would be difficult for the bricklayer because his fingers would be coarsened by bricklaying. Every organ has to experiment, has to endure. Ears may be shocked by a very loud noise. A nose may be offended by a particularly unpleasant odor, but these organs are designed to withstand such shocks. You burn a finger? Well, the finger heals, and we know better next time. Our brains file away all information. It is locked in the 9/10 of the subconscious. Our involuntary nervous system will react on information supplied by the subconscious to prevent us from coming to any great harm. For instance, if you try to walk on the top of a high building, you will experience fear, which is the way the subconscious mind communicates to the involuntary nervous system that it should pour secretions into the blood and make one jump back. This is in the ordinary physical sense, but just think in a much higher dimension how the over-self is unable to receive any knowledge of the earth without putting puppets on the earth. These puppets are humans. Humans who can get burns, cuts, stunned, all manner of things can happen to the human. And all the sensations and impressions are returned to the over-self by way of the silver cord, in much the same way as impressions received by the finger and thumb of the human body are relayed by way of the nerves to the brain, the sensory nerves. We, then, are justified in calling ourselves extensions of an over-self, which is so very highly rarefied, so very highly insulated, so very highly evolved, that it has to depend on us to pick up impressions of what happens on this earth. If we do something wrong, then we get a metaphorical kick in the pants. It is not a devilish god which is afflicting us, persecuting us, or tempting us. It's our own crass stupidity. Or maybe some people touch a thing and find it hurts, and so they touch it again to find out why it hurts. And then they touch it again to find out how the hurt may be cured or overcome. And then they may touch it yet again to see if the matter has been finally overcome. You may get a very good person who gets a lot of pain, and you, the onlooker, may think it is unfair that such a person should have so much suffering. Or you may think that the person concerned is paying back in exceedingly hard karma. He must have been a fiend in a previous life, you may think. But you would be wrong. How do you not know that the person is not enduring the pain and suffering in order to see how pain and suffering can be eliminated for those who come after? Do not think that it is always paying back karma. It may possibly be accumulating good karma. There is a God, a good God, a fair God. But of course, God is not the same as a human, and it is useless to attempt to comprehend what is God, when most people cannot even comprehend their own over-self. Just as you cannot comprehend your over-self, nor can you comprehend the God of your over-self. Here is a question which already has been answered in previous books, but it still comes up regularly, with monotonous regularity, in fact. People want to know about their guide, their master, their keeper, their guardian angel, etc. A person writes and says, "Oh, I have an old red Indian as my guide. I wish I could see him, because he is so wise. How can I see him?" Now, let us get this straight once and for all. People do not have red Indians, black Indians, white Indians, or Tibetans, dead or alive, as guides. Actually, there would not be enough Tibetans, for instance, to go around. It's like everyone saying, "Oh, I was Cleopatra in my last life." There is no word of truth in it. Actually, the alleged guide is just the over-self, who really is our guide. It is like sitting in a car. You are the car's over-self. You stamp on the pedal, and if you're lucky and you don't have a new American car, the car will go. You stamp on another pedal and the car stops, and if you pull a certain thing, and if you're watching what you're doing, you won't run into anything. But no one else but you is driving that car. In the same way, you control yourself. You and your over-self. Many people have the idea that those who have passed from the earth are just bubbling over with enthusiasm to just sit at somebody's shoulder and guide them throughout the days of their life, prevent them from falling by the roadside, telling them what to do and all the rest of that. But just think for yourself. You have neighbors. Possibly you get on with these neighbors, possibly you don't. But anyway, the time has come. You're going to move to the other side of the world. If you are in England, you're going to move to Australia. If you are in North America, you're going to move to, let us say, Siberia. Well, you move. You're busy with your moving. You're busy settling in to your new address. You're busy with your work at your new location. You are busy making fresh contacts. Do you really stop to telephone Tom, Dick, and Harry, and Mary, Martha, and Matilda, or whatever their names are? You don't, you know? You've forgotten all about them. And so do people on the other side. People who have left this earth are not just sitting up on clouds playing their harps and plucking feathers out of their wings, etc., etc. They have a job to do. They leave this earth. They have a period of recuperation, and then they get busy on something else. Quite frankly, they do not have time to be spirit guides and all that rubbish. Many, many times, entities who are not human will be able to intercept the thoughts of a human, and under certain conditions will give the impression of being a spirit guide. Let us consider the case of these seances. Here we have a group of people who are hoping for communication with those who have passed over. They are a group of people who are all thinking along the same lines. It is not just one place for a special purpose, and they are all subconsciously willing that a message shall be given. So, in the astral world, there are drifting forms who may be thought forms, or they may be just entities who have not been humans and never will be humans. They are just masses of energy responding to certain stimuli. These entities, whatever their origin, but certainly they are not human, drift around and soon gravitate to any source which attracts them. If people are thinking strongly about a message from the dead, then these entities will quite automatically be attracted to such a group, and there they will hover around and stretch out pseudopods, which, of course, are hands and fingers made of energy, and they will touch a brain or part of a brain, or touch a cheek, and the person receiving such a touch will be sure that he or she is being touched by a spirit, because the pseudopods they put out are similar to the pseudopods put out of ectoplasm. These entities are often mischievous, and they are very, very alert in the same way that monkeys are alert. The entities float around, sort of bouncing from brain to brain, and when they get some nice juicy item of information which is being radiated from a brain, they can cause a sensitive, that is, a genuine medium, to speak. They give a message which at least one person knows to be true because it's in that person's consciousness. But none of them seem to think of the thought form just picking brains. It must be made very, very clear indeed that not all these manifestations are genuine. We all know what it is like on Halloween when children go about with masks and costumes and pretend to be something. That is how these thought forms, these entities, behave. They are really things of limited intelligence, and they are, quite genuinely, parasites. They will feed upon anything that believes in them. Under certain conditions, a person can have what they believe to be manifestations. They can be sure that they have the spirit of old Fanny, who fell down 3 flights of stairs and broke her leg and died after it, hanging around, advising them, because she is so conscience-stricken because of the way she ignored them when she was on the earth. Well, actually, this is nothing of the sort. The person at the seance might unconsciously have been sending out pictures of Aunt Fanny and her broken leg, thinking what a bad-tempered old biddy she was, and so the mischievous entity will tune in on that and will alter things around a bit, making sure that they're entirely plausible, and then Aunt Fanny comes through as a person who is sorry she was so obnoxious to her brilliant niece or nephew, and now she wants to stay with them forever or longer and protect them from everything. It is really amazing that humans on Earth rather scorn the red man, rather sneer at the Indians, and sometimes tend to disbelieve the authenticity of Tibetan lamas, yet as soon as these people die, the scoffer immediately reverses and thinks that the ones who have been so abused are going to rush back and sit on their shoulders and guide them through life, protecting them from all the troubles of life. Well, they've got another thing coming. All they have, as already stated, is some incubi hanging around, pretending to be something quite different. Your friends on the other side of the world, how often do you get in touch with them? How often do you help them? How often did you help them when they were your neighbors? Now think. A person passes over from this life, and you didn't even know of their existence when they were on this earth. So, quite frankly, why do you think they are suddenly going to take such a vast interest in you? Why do you think that some Tibetan Lama or Red Indian chief is going to drop everything he's doing on the other side and rush to be with you for the rest of your life? Somebody at whom you probably scoffed when he was on the earth, or more probably did not even know that he existed. We must be logical about it. Many people believe they have a spirit guide because they feel insecure, because they feel lonely, because they are sure they cannot manage without help. And so, partly, they invent a father figure or a mother figure who's always with them, protecting them from their own folly and from the ill will of others. Another reason for this belief in spirit guides is that sometimes people hear, or think they hear, a mysterious voice talking to them. What they actually hear is a form of telephone conversation with their own over-self. This is relayed by way of the silver cord. It is amplified by the etheric and sometimes reproduced as vibrations by the aura. Sometimes, too, a person will feel a throbbing on the forehead just between the eyes, but slightly above the eyes. That is caused when a conversation is going on between the subconscious of the human on earth and the over-self. And the 1/10 conscious is trying to listen in, but not being able to do so, and instead getting a throbbing, which is the same as the telephone girl saying that the number is engaged. We have to manage on our own. Every one of us. It is wrong to join cults and groups and gaggles. When we leave this earth, we have to go to the Hall of Memories alone. It is useless for us to go to where we judge ourselves and say to our over-selves, "Oh, the secretary of the Society for Hotter Hot Dogs told me that I should do this or I should not do that." We have to stand alone. And if man is to evolve, man must be alone. If we are going to settle in groups and gangs and cults, well, that is several steps backwards, because when we join a group or a cult or a society, then we're limited to the progress at the rate of the slowest person there. The individualist, the one who wants to get on, the one who is evolved, goes alone, always. So, in passing, an interesting letter was received 2 days ago. It reads, "I have been a member of the such and such society for 44 years, and I must confess that I did not learn so much in all that time as I have learned from one of your books." End of chapter 7.